in October of 1787, there began to appear in the newspapers, particularly in New York, but picked up and republished around the country, a series of letters. These letters were written to the people of New York. They were intended for the people of New York. They were attempting to sway the people of New York, both for ratification of the Constitution and against ratification of the Constitution. They were very well written. They were very persuasive in their arguments. Both sides were very well written and very well thought through. One side, the Federalist Papers, of course, has come down to us, gained fame and fortune, I suppose, because they will ultimately win the argument. They are well thought through and well published and well organized. The other side, the Anti-Federalist Papers, not so much. Not because the arguments aren't good. They are very good arguments. In fact, there is a famed Federalist in Pennsylvania who will take a bunch of these Federalist Papers that he's been given to share with his constituents as part of the debate, and he looks at them and says, these are too good. And he hides them and doesn't let anybody read them because he's afraid that it will convince people to not vote for the Constitution in Pennsylvania. The Anti-Federalists of that day, I have often said, are the ideological grandparents of the libertarian movement today. Now, when I say libertarian, I do not mean Libertarian Party. Please understand that. I do not mean the Libertarian Party. I mean the libertarian ideal. They share many of the same ideas, and they share many of the same flaws in a lot of ways. But the ideas of the Anti-Federalists would not have been foreign if they were brought to this day and they were listening to libertarians. They would hear the same arguments that they had made back in, say, 1788. What has changed is our understanding of the material presented to us, the history, as it were, behind all of this. In 1788, the classical education of people made things seem different, feel different. This matters because many of the arguments that both sides make are couched in that history. They refer directly to that history. They bring it up. But nowhere is that more obvious than in the names that they're going to use. The Federalists, all of the Federalist Papers, which are written, are going to be signed by the pen name Publius. Publius is actually three writers. You probably know this. I'm not telling you anything you don't know. A guy by the name of John Jay, who starts out with good intentions, but doesn't end up participating quite as much. He's quite ill. And unfortunately, his contribution to the Federalist Papers is quite limited. But of course, then there's James Madison, the future president, and the secretary for the convention, who was there for the whole thing. He has his own ideas, and he puts pen to paper for probably at least half of the Federalist Papers. And of course, the third guy, you know, the most well-known name in American history, Alexander Hamilton, who writes many of the Federalist Papers and has several of the ideas. All of these authors use a single name, Publius. It indicates, in many ways, a unity of purpose, and more importantly, a unity of organization. The Federalist Papers are a collaborative idea, and I hate the word collaboration, as you know, but they are an organized idea of three people who were sitting down together and talking through these things. How are we going to present this? This is where the Anti-Federalist Papers fall down. There are, of course, numerous Anti-Federalists. Guys like Patrick Henry might surprise you, but he is an Anti-Federalist. Samuel Adams, yes, the guy for whom the beer company is named, is an Anti-Federalist. In fact, he will famously say of the Constitutional Convention, "I smell a rat." Guy by the name of George Mason, who, although he does not sign the Constitution, does not think that it will work. He becomes an anti-federalist. He is one of the men who stays through the entire convention because he feels like the work is important enough that it has to get done. One that surprises people, James Monroe. Yes, the guy who will eventually become president of the United States and in the 18 teens and lead us to the second war with Britain, the War of 1812. I'm sorry, that's Madison. James Monroe is before that. But bottom line is he does become president, but he's an anti-federalist. Guy by the name of John Hancock. You know this guy, right? Because of his signature. He is vehemently anti-federalist. My favorite anti-federalist, the drunk and disorderly Luther Martin, who we talked extensively about during the ratification, during the convention episodes. Luther Martin is a diehard abolitionist, and he doesn't feel like the Constitution does enough to end slavery, and so he opposes it. There's Richard Henry Lee. This is the man who came up with the idea of putting together the Declaration of Independence. He was the one that made the motion to do that. He is a firm believer in independence. And as a Virginian, he and Monroe, as Virginians, kind of stand in a weird place because most Virginians seemingly are for the Constitution. Guy by the name of Robert Yates, who virtually nobody's ever heard of, but he will actually become one of the leading authors of the Anti-Federalist Papers. But above all of these men stand two. There are two anti-federalist people who really dominate the position. George Clinton is the governor of the state of New York, and he sees the Constitution as proposed as being detrimental to the state of New York. I've mentioned in the past that some of the states were toying with the idea of going their own, and I said on one of the ratification debate podcasts that, in my opinion, at the time, Virginia was one of the few state was the only state that could have done it. I don't think it's that way anymore. New York probably could have survived on her own. What probably would have happened is she would have subsumed Connecticut, Rhode Island, Massachusetts, New Hampshire, and formed her own republic in the North. But she could have done it. And Clinton, who has really the only economy in the entire United States that's actually working, sees the Constitution as trying to take that away. He sees a grave danger in subsuming the states to a powerful national government that will destroy what he has built in New York, and he doesn't want that. The other anti-federalist who most people have never heard of, in fact, it's a name that baseball fans might know slightly, but not really well, a guy by the name of Melancton Smith. In fact, he is so unknown that there's no real actual portraits of him painted. He just seems to be one of those guys that's in the background. But he is very, very, very eloquent in his speaking and particularly his writing. And many people, including myself, believe this is one of the big differences between the Federalists and the Anti-Federalist Papers. The Federalist Papers, we know the three guys that wrote them, and we know almost all of who wrote which one. There's a couple that are kind of, we're not sure, but we know it was one of those three guys, and in most cases, one of those two guys, and we know who wrote most of them. In the case of the Anti-Federalist Papers, we know virtually nothing. I mean, there are some we know who wrote definitively. There are some who we don't know. And as we begin to look at the Anti-Federalist Brutus and his 18 papers that he will write in response to the Federalist Papers, the vast majority of scholarship believes that Melancton Smith is the guy who wrote them. I tend to agree with him, although there is evidence that it may have been someone else. We're not sure, but it makes sense. And so for our purposes here, we will assume that Melancton Smith is the writer of the Anti-Federalist Papers, Brutus. And so all of this brings us to this conflict that we're facing in the papers in New York, the Federalist Papers versus the Anti-Federalist Papers, particularly Brutus. It brings us to this concept of these two groups of papers signed by these names, Publius and Brutus. And why do they use these names? Well, there's a lot of reasons why, but I think the two most important reasons are it separates the writer from the content. In other words, if you don't know that Publius is John Jay, Alexander Hamilton, and Madison, James Madison, you're less likely to use your opinion of them as you judge what they're saying. Like today, it's not what is said, it's who's saying it. And if you can remove that from there, then all of a sudden, it kind of cleans that up a little bit. And the same is true with the Anti-Federalist Papers and Brutus. If you knew that Melancton Smith wrote those papers and you didn't live in New York, you might be going, who the devil is Melancton Smith? Who would name their kid Melancton? Even in this era, who would do that? And so by choosing those names, they remove the writer from the opinion. It would be like having, I guess in a way, it would be like having an anonymous Supreme Court ruling. In some ways, that might be better because you wouldn't know which justice came up with that. You wouldn't know which writer came up with these papers. And so you wouldn't be prejudging the paper by who wrote it. There are people who do that even today. There are people who say, oh, that Dave Bowman guy, I'm not listening to that. I don't care what he has to say. That Rush Limbaugh guy, I don't care what he has to say. I'm not. We all do it. We all do it. And so by removing that, that's one reason why they do that. The second reason is this is an appeal to the emotion and the tradition of the people of New York. They have a much more classical understanding of history than we do today. And these two names, Publius and Brutus, have deep meaning, particularly in that era of the Enlightenment when we were talking about, well, liberty. But in order for us to understand this today, we have to go way back in time, way, way back in time, more than 2,500 years. We go back to 534 BCE. 534 BCE, Tarquinius was upset with the king of Rome. He was the grandson of a previous king of Rome, and he didn't like the new guy. He was angry, and so he accused him of being abusive of his powers. The king admitted to abusing his powers, threw himself upon the mercy of the people, and the people said, no, that's fine. We love it. I'm not making that up. They really did. This did not make Tarquinius happy. So he basically deposed the king, had him executed, and took over as king himself in 534 BCE. Now, Tarquinius does something that is reminiscent of other tyrants throughout history. He gives himself a nickname, like Antiochus names himself Epiphanes, Octavian names himself Augustus, so forth and so on. He does the same thing. He gives himself the name Superbus, Tarquinius Superbus, meaning he is superb. It's where we get our word superb. He's the greatest. He's the coolest. He's the guy. And he begins a 25-year reign in which he basically walks all over the Senate, gets rid of senators, drains the Senate to nothing. And just begins to commit depravity, the likes of which we've rarely seen in history. If any of you have ever seen the movie Caligula, and I'm not recommending that you do, it's not what I'm saying, that movie will actually give you a taste of what the rule of Tarquinius Superbius was like. There was a great deal of sexual depravity, a great deal of abusive depravity. It was not unusual for him to just kill nobles just because they made him mad. He would take freed men and make them slaves. He would make people work for him. He would do just all kinds of things. And one of the worst things he did was he would just start wars. Every time the plebs, the people, would start getting raucous, rebellious, he would start a war. and force them to go fight his never-ending war upon wars in order to drain what was going on, in order to put a stop to it. He was very abusive, very rude, very mean, had his own family members executed. In fact, there's one of his family members who he lets live because this guy's an idiot. He's just slow. He doesn't seem to be all there, but he has the rest of the family killed. And like so many times in history, that was a mistake. There came a night when the war was going on in 509 BCE, and Tarquinius had taken his army to the war. And along with that, he had taken his son and one of his nephews, who were officers in his army. And as so often happens with army troops, they were sitting around one night and debating whose wife was more virtuous. These two guys, his son, who's also named Tarquinius, this is why it gets confusing, and the other guy whose name is Colintius. I always mispronounce it, sorry. Colintinus. And they're arguing about whose wife is more virtuous. And Colintinus is saying, my wife is, because she loves me and she's doing what I have asked her to do. And of course, Tarquinius' son saying, no, my wife's more virtuous. And so they hit upon his bet. And now again, this is where history becomes literature, almost like Shakespeare. There are those who will tell you that this history is myth and that it's just poetry written to celebrate things and to make the Tarquinians look worse than they really were. But keep in mind something. It doesn't matter if it was that or not, because this is what our framers and the generation of our America in 1788 understood as history. We have modern scholarship that goes, well, this may not have happened this way. That doesn't matter, because the people who wrote the Federalist and Anti-Federalist papers, the people who wrote the Constitution, the people who wrote the Declaration of Independence understood this as history, that these two guys got on their horses, rode back to Rome to see whose wife was doing what, with whom, and when. When they got to Rome, they discovered that Tarquinius's wife, as the poet writes, was feasting with intimates, with her intimates, which is a very nice way of saying she was involved in an orgy and was being sexually depraved and not loyal to her husband, who, of course, you know, the idea of marriage is one man, one woman, and so forth and so on. This, of course, put the bet in jeopardy, and especially so when they went to Colonidas's wife, and she was found diligently weaving clothing for her husband and his troops and making sure that equipment was being put together and doing things for her husband that she was supposed to be doing. She was very virtuous and very loyal to her husband, unlike Tarquinius's wife, who was, you know, doing everybody else. This caused Tarquinius to become very, very obsessed with Colintinus's wife, Lucrezia. And he decided that he was going to have her. And so over the next couple of weeks, he kept going back to Rome and pressuring her. And eventually he told her that she had to have relations with him. And if she didn't, he was going to kill her and tell everyone else that he had found her with a slave, having relations with a slave, and, you know, essentially blackmail her. And so, in one of the tragic incidents of history, Tarquinius's son, Tarquinius, raped Lucrezia. And she, of course, was hideously shamed by this, embarrassed by this, and problematic for her. After everything happened, she called her husband, Colintinus, and her father, and some of their friends, one of whom happened to be that idiot guy. Remember him that didn't get killed by the king because he was, you know, slow and dumb? And those friends came, and she explained everything that was happening to them, to her. And then she stabbed herself in the chest and killed herself right in front of them. And this, of course, inflamed passions. It inflamed anger. It was then that this man named Brutus, which, by the way, in Latin means dullard or idiot, stepped forward, grabbed the knife out of her chest, yanked it out, held it up, and said, "We will kill any man who desires to rule Rome by himself." There are four of these guys, Colonidas, Brutus, a couple of others as well. Publius is one of them, that are then going to call the people together, showing them the knife, showing them the body of Lucrezia. The people are just furious about this. They gather the Senate. The Senate is furious about this, and it deposes Tarquinius Superba. It tells him, "You're no longer king, go away," and sends him into exile. And Brutus stands before all of the people, and he says, "From now on, every Roman will take an oath, a swearing of an oath, that no Roman will suffer any man to rule Rome. The people will always be desirous of new liberty and will not be swayed by the entreaties and bribes of kings. And any person who in the future attempts to rule Rome by themselves is to be killed along with their entire house." Do you follow what I'm saying here? This is the beginning, not just of the Roman Republic, but this is the oath that every Roman citizen will now take, which is that there will never be another king of Rome. And that any man who tries to rule Rome by himself is to be killed. Which leads us, of course, 400 years later, to another Brutus, who Roman tradition holds is a direct descendant of the first Brutus. Marcus Brutus goes into the Senate on the Ides of March in the year 44 BCE, and there stands a man who wants to rule Rome all by himself, who says, "You too, Brutus?" Well, of course, with a name like Brutus and the oath of Brutus and the Republic's protection at hand, what choice did he have? If he truly believes these things, then he had to help assassinate Julius Caesar and help restore the Republic, which, sadly, did not work. These two names, Publius and Brutus, both there when Tarquinius is deposed, both of them are part of that group that is there when Lucrezia kills herself. These are two men who are bound up in this moment in history when the Roman king is deposed. Now, just a little sidelight, doesn't really make that much difference. Colintitus and Brutus are actually elected as the first two consuls of Rome. But Colintitus is seen as being a direct royal connection. He's problematic because he is a royal. He's a nephew of the king, Tarquinius, who, by the way, is not dead. And this could be a problem. So the people say, "Well, we just don't really want a royal doing this." And so he resigns, and Publius is elected as the second consul of Rome. So Publius and Brutus become the first real consuls of Rome, and they begin to establish the laws of Rome. They begin to do these things. Publius, of course, is one of the men who founds the Republic. As I said, Publius is actually an honorary title that he's given much later in life because it literally means of the public. He serves the public. He has spent his life speaking in defense of the plebs, even under the king. And after Tarquinius is deposed and goes away, it's Publius who hears about a plot. There's a foul plot afoot in the capital of Rome to reinstall Tarquinius Superbus. He wants to come back. And there are a bunch of plotters and there are a bunch of people planning for this. And it's Publius who actually goes and gathers the direct evidence of this and exposes the plot. He's the one who does this. And that is seen as another moment where the Roman Republic is victorious, and it's Publius who really makes that happen. He's not a perfect guy, by the way. He does make a mistake. He decides to build a house, and he wants to build a house on top of a hill because he wants to be able to see. Well, the people see him building this house, and they think, wait a sec, why is he building a house up at the top of the hill? And the people accuse him of being having royal aspirations, having aspirations of setting himself up as king. He says, no, I just liberated Rome bravely, but now I'm being slandered. I'm the bitterest enemy of the former kings, so I shouldn't be accused of wanting to be a king. And he destroys the house in one night. He tears the whole thing down. Roman tradition holds that he did it by himself. It's hard to believe, but they did. And after that, a temple called the Temple of Victory is built on that site where his house stood. And it's one of the ruins that you can visit in Rome today. Publius is considered by, as the historians write, he's considered by universal consent to be the ablest man in Rome. Listen to this. In peace and in war. Does that phrase sound familiar to you at all? Does that phrase kind of ring a bell in the back of your head going, wait, where have I heard that? I've heard that somewhere. Where have I heard that? Oh, yeah. George Washington, first in peace, first in war. And so by adopting this name Publius, there's almost like this connection. Publius, George Washington, right? George Washington uncovered plots. George Washington overthrew a tyrant. George Washington went home as Publius did. Publius, when he dies, he is completely, he's in poverty. He has no money. He has not gotten wealthy in the service of his country. He has to be buried at the expense of the people. People make donations to bury him and to have his funeral. And of course, modern scholars look at this whole thing and go, well, that's ridiculous. That's just literature. It's not history. But in 1977, there was a digging going on, and an inscription was discovered that proved the existence of a man who went by the name of Publius. The name that fits here, and I realize looking at that, you probably can't read that, and neither can I, but it proved that at least someone with that name and surname existed in that time frame, and so kind of gave some impetus to this. That's the story of Publius. The other man's name, of course, is Brutus, and Brutus literally translates as dullard or idiot, who... Well, it's not a very flattering name, is it? He's the nephew of the king, Tarquinius Superbus, who had his entire family killed, and he survived by acting like he was a moron. He didn't understand anything. He didn't grasp any of what was going on. And so he was allowed to live because he didn't seem to be a threat. Again, his story... Modern scholars look at it, they go, well, that's just literature. It's not history. But I say to you again, one of Dave's maxims, I learned this when I was in the Holy Land many years ago. One of the things that had happened in the Holy Land was that Helena, the mother of Constantine the Great, had gone to the Holy Land. And there in the early centuries, right after Christianity had been founded, she was shown the sites of places of things that had happened because they were not that far removed from them happening. And so she had them marked, and that's why some of the churches are where they are now and some of the churches are challenged as well. It couldn't have been there. It must be somewhere else. But I think if you trust the tradition, you'll find that in many cases, the tradition is right. And in the same way, I think that we can say, well, this is just literature about Brutus. We can say that it's just a story, almost a Shakespearean story, although he wasn't alive yet. But really, tradition has its place. And more importantly, the framers, the founders, the people of the state of New York, and the writers of the Federalist and Anti-Federalist papers would have known this as history. Brutus is trustworthy enough that he has made kind of a political figure. He's controllable by the king is what he's seen. And he's distant family. So we got to put up with him. And in fact, he is a friend or friendly with the sons of Tarquinius, including Tarquinius, the man who raped Lucrezia. And at one point, they travel to the oracle at Delphi. And the two sons of Tarquinius ask the oracle at Delphi, who is going to rule Rome? Who is going to rule? And the oracle responds, the first to kiss their mother shall hold sway in Rome. Brutus understands this to mean that the earth, Gaia, is their mother. And so he immediately bends down and kisses the earth, whereas the two sons of Tarquinius do not. They rush home to pull to kiss their mother. Eventually, the bet over the woman that we talked about, Lucrezia, is that goes through. The men are the people who oppose Tarquinius, Brutus, Publius, Colintidus, they're all furious. But it's Brutus who pulls the knife from her breast, holds it up, and says, we will kill the king. We will destroy the king. It's Brutus that convinces the Senate to depose the king. And more importantly, he convinces the army to support them in establishing a new government and getting rid of the king. The king flees. And as we talked about, the oath of Brutus takes form as a Roman pledge. He's also responsible in many ways. He is responsible for the oaths of office that officials take when they take their office. He is responsible for the Curiate Assembly, which becomes an important part of Roman law and Roman rule, Roman Republic rule. He is the one who establishes the concept of alternating power, that no one person should have power for too long. For those of you who like the term, term limits. He brings back the Senate. Tarquinius Superbus had just decimated the Senate, but it's Brutus who restores the Senate to its proper place. And of course, most importantly, I guess, in the big scheme of things, he is responsible for dedication of many, many temples and restoring the faith of Rome. But it's that moment when he pulls that knife out of Lucrezia's breast that really establishes Brutus as one of the most important leaders in all of history, and a man who, along with Publius, will essentially found the Roman Republic. The problem is, of course, as we talked about before, remember that plot that was going on in the background? That there's this plot going on to restore Tarquinius Superbus to power. Well, in order to do that, of course, there's going to have to be bloodshed. Brutus, Publius, Colintidus, all these other guys are going to have to be killed. Lucrezia's father is going to have to be killed. And there's going to be a lot of problems. Well, of course, it's Publius who goes and discovers where the plotters are, what they're doing, their plans, exposes them for the entire world to see, and they are all arrested and put on trial. What surprises everyone is that two of the plotters, two of the men who are planning to kill Brutus, Publius, Lucrezia's dad, whose name I'm not even going to try to say, and Colintidus, along with others, are Brutus's own two sons. His own two sons have plotted with Tarquinius because they see themselves as, you know, relatives. They see themselves in line for power. And perhaps even they kiss their mother. I don't know. But these two young men are involved with them. And it's Brutus who has to condemn them to death for their action as part of the plot to restore Tarquinius to rule and destroy the nascent republic. And so he watches, after he passes sentence, he watches as his two young sons, well, not young, but you know, you get the idea, as his two young sons are first stripped, beaten, and then beheaded. And we're told that he watches with stoic unemotional attitude that he doesn't really say or do anything as these two young men are executed. And as their bodies are brought back to his home, he doesn't even mourn them. He doesn't even react, even though his wife and other children are very, very upset by all of this. That's the story of Brutus, who the Anti-Federalists chose as their pen name. These two names have very, very deep meaning, particularly to those who understand and pursue the ideas of liberty and Republican government, not party Republican, but Republican little r. Each of these men were founders of the Roman Republic, to which the writers of the Federalist Papers and the Anti-Federalist Papers are going to appeal as examples of why we should or should not have this Constitution. And you might say to yourself, well, wait, Dave, wouldn't they both want the Constitution, or wouldn't they both want no Constitution? It's not that simple, is it? Because there are clear and specific warnings about character and conduct in each of these two men. Publius will protect the rights of the people, but he also doesn't think clearly sometimes. He wants to build a house up on the hill, which maybe there's nothing wrong with it, but it looks bad. But at the same time, he shows humility because he doesn't have any money. He's not getting rich in the service of his country. Brutus, on the other hand, is willing to sacrifice everything for liberty. Liberty becomes the focal point for him. The Republic becomes the focal point to himself, where he's willing to sacrifice everything, including his own family. This lacks emotion. It lacks mercy, which are two qualities that perhaps we would want to see. But both are seen as heroes to Republican values and to liberty. Now, the Republic that they will found, the Roman Republic, founded in 509 BCE, which existed until 44 BCE, when Julius Caesar was assassinated and Octavian established the empire. The Republic had many, many problems. And many of those problems are similar to the problems we have today. And many of those problems are similar to the problems they had in 1788. It will surprise you when we get to those. And it's the Anti-Federalist, Brutus, who points out the fact that even though we founded this republic, it had issues that this Constitution, as proposed, doesn't really solve or address. He points out those issues. And maybe that's why Melanchthon Smith chose that name, because it has a deeper meaning then than it does today. We don't know this history. Either way, both of the names have deeper meaning. Both of the names have a different appeal to the public who would be reading them, who would have this understanding, who knew this history innately, who understood it because they learned it as part of their classical education. The names represent an appeal to the history and the emotion which was well understood in that day. And in that context, we are going to begin to explore their argument in favor of and against the Constitution. Hopefully, we today, 202 centuries beyond the Federalists and Anti-Federalists, the Publius and Brutus of that era, hopefully we will gain a better understanding ourselves of what they were saying to us 2 centuries later.